because this is the way in which society secures cooperation. The combined interaction of individuals in a society sets these prices. And this is society's information to all of the individuals in society, telling them what they ought to do. We were talking about this a little while yesterday in reference to, among other things, price of milk. And when the price of milk falls, of course, that makes dairy farmers very angry. And they say, I'm going to leave dairy farming, by golly. And in a way, that's what society is telling them to do when the price of milk goes down, in a way. Now, it sounds cruel and callous, and that vastly oversimplifies the problem. But that's what happens. When the price of something goes down, society is saying, we don't want this done so badly anymore. Or if it's a resource, society is saying, there's plenty of this available, take all you want. When the price goes up, society is saying, we want this done badly. Or if it's a resource, society is saying, economize with this, it's very scarce, it's much in demand. All right. Well, now, if we use, all that was review, while Eleanor was getting cranked up. Yeah. If we use what I call the organizational technique as the defining characteristic of an economic system, then I would assert that there's only one kind of economy in our world today. And I exclude these little enclaves in the South Sea Islands or something like that. I'm talking about the countries that are members of the United Nations. There's only one kind, and that's a mixed command market economy. But of course, there is a rich variety of mixtures, and no two countries mix command and the market to the same extent. These mixes, I think we should be very careful about why they exist. These mixes are a product of all sorts of things. A particular country, Egypt, will mix the command technique and the market technique for a variety of reasons, having to do with resource availability in relation to wants. I mean, the fact that the Nile River flows through the middle of Egypt and the rest of Egypt is pretty arid will have something to do with that decision. Political history. The fact that the Egyptians resent the British will have something to do with it. You know, if you resent the British and the British do it this way, you tend to do it that way. Factionalism of class, of language, of nationality within a so-called nation has much to do with the kind of technique that is used to secure cooperation. Ideology has a lot to do with it. And as I said, socialism, I think, is more of an ideology in our world than it is an economic system. So people respond to socialistic slogans, you know, equality, brotherhood, people's control, people's democracy. These are good phrases. And so you use these. And sometimes you don't really intend anything by using the phrases except to gain popular support and hosannas from the people. But sometimes you get to be the captive of your own rhetoric. And of course, evolution by trial and error. Sometimes sensible, pragmatic evolution, and sometimes rather silly evolution. You know, it isn't true that we always learn by trial and error. Sometimes we unlearn by trial and error. I think it's a myth to suppose, as we frequently do, that economic systems of the world have evolved into their present form through a rational critique of capitalism, which was the original and basic economic system. This is nonsense. There has been very little rational critique of capitalism in our world, and capitalism wasn't the basic and original system. But what is capitalism, anyhow? What I really want to get into today, and sort of ramble around with, is the meaning that these phrases, capitalism and socialism, might have in our world. And I want to suggest some of the dangers even of using the terms. If you define capitalism as it is usually defined, and I think best defined, as a market-organized economy with private ownership and control of property, a market-organized economy with private ownership and control of property. So you could have a market-organized economy with public ownership. It wouldn't work in the same way, and there's some question whether it would work well at all. But you could have it. And similarly, you could have private ownership and control of property, but you could organize the economy by command. Sometimes called authoritarian capitalism. Hitler messed around with that sort of thing. The fascist state in Italy diddled with that somewhat. You have some of this in Spain, a lot of it in Latin America. But if you have these two things together, market organization, basically, in the economic system, and private ownership and control of property, then you have what we call capitalism. Well, if that's the definition, capitalism was not the original economic system. If you think back in the world's history, there's always been, of course, some private ownership and control of property, but through most of history has been seriously hedged around with restrictions as to use. People were not free to do with their property as they would. Think back to the Old Testament, the restrictions on what one could do with his property in the Old Testament. Remember the story of Naboth's vineyard. King Ahab wanted that vineyard and Naboth couldn't sell it to him. It was just something that you didn't do with property. You couldn't do it. It was contrary to the law of God and of man. The year of Jubilee in the Old Testament, which was honored more in the breach than the observance, which required people after certain, after 50 years, you freed all your slaves, every 50th year, I don't know the details, but you freed your slaves and you gave them some property. It was a sort of the year in which everything got equalized and leveled once again. Through the Middle Ages, all of the restrictions that canon law and civil law placed upon the use of property. And even beyond the Middle Ages, all of the regulations that the state laid down about economic activity. There's a popular belief that the United States was founded on the basis of the principles of free enterprise, which were betrayed somewhere around the 1930s by Franklin D. Roosevelt. If you go back to the pre-revolutionary period, especially, the United States was in no sense of the term a free enterprise country. I once compiled a list, which I mimeographed to distribute to students in the economic history course, of as many laws as I could find regulating economic activity in the colony of Virginia. Because everybody thinks Virginia is really free. You know, that was the place Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson and true free enterprise. An incredible list. They regulated how you made flour and how many pounds of bacon you put in a barrel. They subsidized all kinds of activities, penalized others, compelled people to engage in certain kinds of work and forbade them to do other things. It was an extraordinarily regulated economy. There was a very good reason for regulating it. It was obvious to the good burgesses of Virginia, as it was obvious to almost everybody in the 18th century, that unless the government, as the responsible body representing the will and interest of society, unless the government minutely controlled people's economic activity, we would not obtain cooperation. Everybody would just go off in his own direction. Everybody would say, go off into the, well, even an actual example from Virginia. Everybody would abandon the fertile lands of the coast and go back into the hinterland. And the basic agricultural needs of Virginia would be forsaken, and instead everybody would be out there raising tobacco. And therefore it was essential for the colony of Virginia to very minutely control people and say, so many of you got to do this and so many of you got to do that, which is obvious. Otherwise, economic life flies apart. Well, capitalism, I think, is most usefully thought of as a concept. And a concept which contradicts the thinking that I've just been talking, been expressing, the attitudes, the basic presuppositions that I've just been expressing. And capitalism as a concept only arrived in the late 18th century. And I would associate it with Adam Smith. He was certainly the apostle of its maturity, anyway. Adam Smith, in 1776, published his great book, The Wealth of Nations. And his genius lay in his ability to pull together and to systematize and give coherence to what men were just beginning to realize at the dawn of what we call the Industrial Revolution. This concept of a different way of ordering society, Smith did not call capitalism. He called it the system of natural liberty. And Smith was a heretic in his time. It's important to remember what a heretic he was. His fundamental heresy was his argument that the wants of individuals and of society as a whole do not have to be provided for by the state or any other group charged with looking out for the system of social cooperation. Smith said, adequate social cooperation emerges spontaneously, automatically, when everyone is left free to pursue his own interest. Now, you've got to remember what heresy that was in 1776. Probably it's become heresy again for many people. But For many people, of course, in America, it's also accepted gospel and unquestionable. But anybody who knows anything about economic systems realizes today that Smith was basically right, certainly right in the context of his times. Governments were engaged in regulating all kinds of things when there was absolutely no need to regulate them, and when the regulation led to pernicious results, when the regulation had the consequence just the opposite of what the government intended. The dominant political economic philosophy of Smith's time and on into the 19th century was what we today call mercantilism. Mercantilism was the economic philosophy of the crown and of the people. It was just self-understood. It was obvious that mercantilism was true. Mercantilism believed that if everybody follows his own interest, chaos ensues. Ain't that right? I mean, if you tell all the kids, if you've got 18 kids in the house, and you say, okay, kids, you can do anything you want to do, what happens? Chaos, obviously. Everybody will cut everybody else's throat. The biggest kids will take all the toys, and little kids won't get any. Everybody's going to look out for himself, and because nobody is looking out for the whole, really, no one's desires will finally be satisfied. See, the big kids will take all the toys, and so the little kids will get mad, and they'll burn the house down. They'll double sheet the big kid's bed. And you're just going to have chaos and fighting and misery for everybody. In a well-ordered society, the state must direct, control, prohibit, provide, and so on. A good model, in order to realize how the mercantilists thought, you might take the model of a fishing ground. I think this is the kind of model they had in mind. A fishing ground out in the ocean, nobody owns it. What happens if everyone is just free to pursue his own interest and fish as much as he wants to out there? Eventually, the fishing ground will be destroyed because it's not in the interest of anybody to leave some more fish there. You know, you can say, well, gee, if we take too many fish out, they won't be able to reproduce themselves, and next year when we come back to this fishing bank, there won't be very many fish. That makes sense, but it makes sense only for the group as a whole. I'm an individual fisherman, one out of 500 who are fishing that fishing bank. Do I have any interest in restraining myself? No. What's my interest in doing? What difference will it make? So I say, I'm going to take only half as big a catch as I could take in order to preserve the fish for next year. Nobody else is going to do it. What difference will it make? I'll just deprive myself of revenue, and I won't do anything significant, really, to maintain the fishing ground. Here's a clear case where you need some kind of social control. You've got to limit everybody's catch. Well, Smith found this to be a generally inapplicable model. He says that's not basically the way the economic world is, because in the real world, most resources are privately owned, and that makes all the difference in the world. See, the reason that you irresponsibly use that fishing ground is because you don't own it. But if you did own it, and you had a big fence around it, and you were the only one allowed to take fish out, you would fish it in quite a different way. Everybody, when I was in prep school, high school, junior college, lived in dormitories, and of course, we'd go down the hall smoking a cigarette and throw it on the floor. Bought it. They were concrete floors. They didn't do any permanent damage. But the constant complaint that the house fathers and the dormitory counselors would register, you don't do that at home, do you? You know, we'd feel very guilty and pick up the buttons, and no, we don't do that at home. Why do we do it here? Very simple reason. Home is ours. The dormitory doesn't belong to anybody. We desecrate public property. We throw more litter in a public park than we throw in our own backyard for the very simple reason that we have no real intense interest in the public park. We're going to leave there tomorrow. That belongs to everybody. Everybody's business is nobody's business. Everybody's property is nobody's property. But in the economic world, Smith said, most property is privately owned. And this gives people a real passionate interest in using it wisely and well. And in such a case, Smith maintained, everybody will serve the public interest most effectively if he just tends as well as he can to his own interest. If he makes the most effective use, for himself, of course, for his own benefit, of the property that he owns, then he will be ministering most effectively to the public good. You all recall the famous invisible hand passage. Everyone who pursues his own interest is led by an invisible hand to promote an end that was no part of his intention. When the state does not intervene, Smith said, competition holds each one in check, and so the interest of all is provided for. And competition simply means the alternatives that others offer. And in fact, when you look at state intervention, Smith said, the state has promoted monopoly. And so the state has prevented the beneficial working of competition. You can't expect anything good from, Smith put it, that crafty and insidious animal called a statesman. Because statesmen are bureaucrats, and bureaucrats are always more ignorant about my property than I am. I know much more about my property and what it's good for and what can be done with it than any bureaucrat does. I have much more incentive than the bureaucrat to use those resources well. And Smith's third point that runs through the Wealth of Nations, government officials are corrupt. Now, this has sometimes been quoted as a generalization about government officials. In behalf of Adam Smith, point out that in England in the late 19th century, government officials were extraordinarily corrupt. You just didn't get a decent job without paying a bribe. Justice could be purchased, and that's about the only way it could be secured. But the basic message then of Adam Smith was, get the government out of economic life. It doesn't do as good a job of securing cooperation as you get if you leave the government out. Moreover, every piece of government intervention leads to the wrong kind of results. That was a period. Marks the end of a paragraph. By the way, Smith did not believe in laissez-faire. As I've been describing his views, maybe you conclude that Smith did believe in laissez-faire. One of his biographers says all of Adam Smith's biographers agree that he was extraordinarily absent-minded. And one of the things he was absent-minded about was his system of natural liberty. So you'll find Smith saying it's the natural system of liberty, the only true and just system, and talking as if government should do absolutely nothing. But he's very absent-minded about that because throughout the Wealth of Nations, and especially the big Book 5 on the duties of the state, you find that Adam Smith allowed the government all kinds of activities that that even some Democrats of the left wing might consider a little radical today. Smith was not a kind of a dogmatic, keep the government out of life. Smith was looking at his times, basically, and saying, people are fundamentally mistaken. Government is not needed the way people think it is, and it isn't as effective as people suppose either. The basic need of our time is to get government out of economic life and then put it back in where it can really do some good. But basically, the economy regulates itself if you just leave everybody free to pursue his own interest in a society with private ownership of property. Well, Adam Smith was not only the first to come up with a clear concept now of what I call capitalism, of the system that works according to without direct command from the center, but he was also the father of economics. Most histories of economic thought, they'll diddle around a little bit with the Greeks and the Romans, bow to Thomas Aquinas, castigate the physiocrats and the mercantilists, and then Adam Smith, and we begin. 1776, the Declaration of Independence and the Wealth of Nations. That suggests, what is true, that economics as a science or a discipline and capitalism developed together. They did. And economics, for a long time, was a kind of apologetic for capitalism. Because economics, as developed by Smith and his major successors, I won't bore you with their names, through the 19th century, economics concerned itself intensely and sometimes exclusively with spelling out the logic of a system characterized by private ownership of property and competition in free markets. It tried to show in a very logical, semi-mathematical way what the tendencies were that emerged from such an economy. And these tendencies were all very good. They demonstrated logically that if you had free markets and competition and private ownership of property, you would get all kinds of good things. In fact, the best possible. These were the tendencies that emerged. And they tended to demonstrate that any kind of intervention led to bad consequences, unintended but definitely evil consequences. Well, as a result, of course, economists were stamped in the minds of many as nothing but apologists for capitalism. And one of the men who believed that was Karl Marx. I want to, before getting into Marx and showing what Marx saw wrong with this whole system and with economics, I want to point out some things that the economists up until almost, oh, say, the 1930s, the classical economists of England and the United States and continental Europe, some things that they did wrong. They tended to ignore or minimize the importance of certain problems and to assert the inevitability of others. The main problem that they ignored, they just overlooked it completely, was the problem of development. The problem of economic history, of the transformation of economic institutions. They tended to assume that the whole world was like England, or shortly would be, or certainly should be, and it was rather stupid if you weren't. But you know, England was in a very peculiar position in the 19th century. England had the most well-developed market institutions, besides the fact, of course, that England had very carefully exploited many of her natural resources, from her coal mines to her coastline. England was really unique. The classical economists of the 19th century frequently talk as if a country is poor, well, stupid, why don't you do what England does? And the trouble is, they didn't have that option. They hadn't developed to the position of England yet. How do countries evolve and develop? How do market institutions evolve? Well, the classical economists were not remotely interested in this question. They were not interested in dynamic analysis at all, in the evolution of economic institutions. They, as Karl Marx thought, saw the capitalist market economy as something that dropped full-blown from heaven. And having been revealed to man, it was now man's responsibility to adopt it. Whether he lived in the Fiji Islands or in the Aleutians, it was his task to adopt capitalism. Well, this was very unhistorical and unrealistic. The second, I said, that's the problem they ignored. The problem whose importance they minimized was the problem of unemployment. Now, they were aware of unemployment. They called it the trade cycle, or the crisis. They were aware of the fact, they saw it obviously through the 19th century and into the 20th, that capitalist economies, the economies whose praises they sang, had a tendency to go up and down. At times everything was going well and workers were employed and happy and wages were rising and profits were good and sales were booming and everyone just felt 4th of July-ish. But then all of a sudden something would happen. The banks would close, you couldn't borrow money, mortgages were foreclosed, people were thrown out of work, you couldn't sell anything, inventories piled up, profits disappeared, bankruptcies increased. The crisis. Well, they saw the phenomenon, but they proved, or maybe they believed, they assumed, that it was temporary. These are temporary crises. They had explanations for them, but all of these explanations demonstrated that they were temporary phenomena. If you just wait, they will disappear. In other words, so 6 million people are unemployed. This is a temporary phenomenon. This is a shaking out period of the economy. It's a kind of paying for the excesses of the previous boom period. If you wait, eventually all of these people will be re-employed. Chronic unemployment, persistent, long-run unemployment is impossible. Moreover, attempts to alleviate this kind of short-run, temporary unemployment, or attempts to, in general, temper the wind to the shorn lamb during periods of crisis, they will not really succeed in doing anything except prolonging the crisis and making it more severe. So what do you do in periods of depression and recession? What should the government do? Nothing. Because it couldn't really do anything except make the situation worse. And if you say, my God, people are unemployed, they say, be patient. We must all learn patience. Well, that's called minimizing the importance of a problem. Then, the inevitability. So there was one problem that they asserted was inevitable, and that was poverty for many. Now, lots of people today believe that it's important to war on poverty. And that implies that we think poverty can be eliminated. We think it's possible to. It's not always clear what people have in mind. Are we going to, upper middle class, are we going to stay up here and we're going to raise the poor? I think that's what we hope anyway. Or are we going to take some out of our pockets in order to bring them up so that we, you know, level this way? Well, there are some people who aren't willing to, of course, there are some who aren't willing to accept equalization under any terms. But some people who are willing to war on poverty if it means bringing the poor up here. There are some who are willing to war on poverty if it means going like that. But I don't think there are many who are willing to war on poverty if it means going like that. Huh? And the classical economists argued that inevitably, if you war on poverty, that's what happens. There's only one way to level, and that's level down. Why? There are a whole variety of reasons, but I think there are two that are most prominent. One is, they were tremendously impressed with the natural inequality of people. You try to give everybody the same, it just doesn't work because people aren't the same. Differences in income reflect basically differences in people's skills, abilities, ambition, and all this sort of stuff. And the second, then, is related to it. If you still try to make all people equal, you will simply destroy incentive, you'll destroy the basis of production, and hence you won't have much left to distribute. So, unfortunately, there ain't much we can do about it. John Stuart Mill, who is sometimes called a utopian socialist and who was sort of one of the great classic figures in the classical economists, who was a contemporary too of Karl Marx, Mill was profoundly sympathetic with the sufferings of the poor and the unemployed and the working class, and he looked forward to the day in the, he hoped, not too distant future when the inequalities of income would be alleviated through a gradual accumulation of more and more economic surplus. But for the present, Mill said, I'm afraid there just isn't much that we can do to make the distribution of income more equal. If we do, we'll interfere with the engine of progress, of capital accumulation, and we'll just make things worse off. We have to be patient, but Mill didn't think we had to be patient too long. He does make the statement that if we had to choose between this present unjust system where those who do the least work get the most money, and those who toil the hardest at the most menial occupations get the least, or communism, I would prefer communism. But, he says, fortunately, it isn't necessary to make that choice. Economic progress under capitalism, the competitive system is going forward, and gradually the poor are being brought up, and they're being educated and elevated and all of that. And eventually, through the natural processes, we will pull the poor up. But social intervention to do something about the inequality of income is not likely to be very effective and is going to do more harm than good. Well, these, I think, are shortcomings. When you minimize the importance of problems that are really bugging people, when you say that something like the inequality of income, which bothers many good people, clergymen in their pulpits and reformers in their lecture halls, when you say there ain't nothing you can do about it, you get people irritated. No one was more irritated than Karl Marx. Karl Marx, in the 19th century, fashioned an enormous engine of analysis to replace bourgeois economics, as he called it. Well, I bet you should be careful, not replace, really supplement. Marx's economics has four characteristics that I want to mention, and I'm talking about Karl Marx. I'm not talking about people who call themselves Marxists today. Marx's economics, and you'll see how this ties up with the deficiencies I was just talking about, is in the first place dynamic, evolutionary, historical. Marx, as he says, is out to show the laws of motion of the capitalist system. Marx wanted to show how it develops over time as a total sociological and historical institution, how it matures, develops contradictions, dissolves, and gets replaced by something better. The static analysis of the classical economist Marx took for granted, but he went on. How does this system evolve? The second characteristic of Marx's analysis, which many people forget, is that it is an analysis of capitalism, not of socialism. You can't find more than a couple of pages in the entire corpus of Marx's writings, and it's an enormous corpus. Be stacked up about that high. He's almost as prolific as Luther. You can't find more than a couple of pages talking about the coming socialist society. Marx, in fact, was very critical of his contemporaries and friends who tried to blueprint the socialist society. Marx believed in history, and when the socialist society comes, history will provide. Take, therefore, no thought for the morrow. History will tell us what the socialist society looks like when it comes. Those who tried to blueprint it were utopians. And, of course, that created some problems for the Russians in 1917, because they hadn't gone through all the Marxist stages. And in Marxist terms, they weren't ready yet for socialism. History hadn't prepared its gifts. And here they were. They were setting up a socialist society without the cooperation of history or the cooperation of Marx. And they had to kind of blunder their way through. The third characteristic of Marx's analysis is its prophetic and moral quality. Now, really, this is a bit inconsistent. As Marx says, capitalism evolves inevitably in a certain direction and all these evils will be destroyed. Then what business does he have in leveling moral indictments at people? If the capitalist is simply the tool of the historical process, you can't really blame him, but Marx does. And of course, it is this Old Testament prophet in Marx that has been responsible for most of Marx's popularity. These are the sections of Marx that are read. People rarely sit down and analyze his system of circulation of commodities or distinguish between surplus value under one set of conditions and under another set of conditions. But people do read the Communist Manifesto, which says, "Working men of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains." And those moving words in Volume 1 of Das Kapital, where he talks about the integument of capitalist production bursts asunder, the knell of the expropriators is sounded, the expropriators are expropriated. You know, and you get all, you know, it's a grand vision. And this, of course, is what has captured the imagination of people in the late 19th and early 20th century. Marx, the prophet. The fourth and last characteristic, Marx traced the perceived failures of capitalism, mainly its failure to provide for what most people thought was an equitable distribution of income, plus its inability to eliminate recurrent crises. Marx traced these perceived failures, these principal shortcomings, to the internal contradictions of capitalism itself. These were not problems that you could get rid of by aspirin tablets. You couldn't patch up the capitalist system in order to solve these problems. They were endemic to the capitalist system itself. It was just part of the system. Now, if you're a good, faithful, devout capitalist, and you believe that, you despair. But if, like Marx, you believe that capitalism inevitably evolves because of its contradictions into something better and grander and nobler, you take heart. And you cheer for the failures, so that when millions of people are thrown out of work, you say, "Hurrah, hurrah, the kingdom of God draweth near." And so you get this interesting phenomenon of the lovers of the proletariat cheering when the proletariat is suffering and starving, because this proves that history is approaching its end. Well, now, are there any Marxists in our world? This, what I tried to present now was capitalism as seen by its intelligent, well, by the most intelligent and systematic defenders and constructors of the concept of capitalism, the classical economists. And then I tried to summarize the most rational and coherent critique of capitalism, Karl Marx's. Are there any capitalists or Marxists in our world today in this sense? Not very many. As for the Marxists, there is one pure Marxist party, the Socialist Labor Party in the USA. I'm sure there are some others floating around. This is not the relatively big one that Norman Thomas was associated with, a very small one founded by Daniel De Leon back in the 19th century. You rarely hear anything about it. They run some lady occasionally for president. I forget any cousins. Georgia Cousins? No. I don't even remember. But they're pure Marxists. Then you have some academic Marxists. They have revised Marx a little bit. They've corrected some of his historical blunders, some of his bad predictions, or reinterpreted them. And they have added to Marx a theory of monopoly capitalism. If you want to read this group, they're best represented in this country in the Monthly Review, a publication that comes out of New York. But they are pretty much academic. Almost all of these guys are in universities or in working or writing. I mean, they're not organizing. They're interesting and provocative and all of that, but they're not terribly influential politically. If you want to find really influential Marxists in the world today, you've got to go find people who are rotten Marxists. And there are two kinds of rotten Marxists who are very influential: the revisionists explicit and the revisionists implicit. The implicit or the explicit revisionists are the Fabians of all sorts. The Fabian socialists are the "let's take it slow" socialists. Fabian Cunctator was a Roman general who defeated Hannibal by never fighting him. Hannibal drew up his troops for battle. Fabian drew up his troops, and Hannibal got ready to charge, and Fabian snuck off. And so Hannibal just went up and down Italy trying to engage Fabian in battle, and finally his logistic problems became so serious that he had to go back to Carthage, and Fabian beat him without fighting. So Fabian cunctator means Fabian the delayer. Well, the Fabian socialists, the name originated in England around the turn of the century, were socialists who believed we'll get there by delay. Don't fight any real battles, just hit and miss, you know, send out cavalry sorties or something like that. And eventually we'll evolve into the socialist society. Well, that's very un-Marxist. Marx would have looked at all these Fabian socialists and said, you're hopelessly utopian. But these people have a deep respect for Karl Marx. You go into the, and of course, the socialist parties of Western Europe are Fabian socialists, predominantly in this sense now. And Marx would have dismissed them, as I say, as hopeless utopians. But their attitude is, we take from Marx what is true, which turns out to be, I think, very little more than moral indignation. It'll maybe a little terminology. But politically, of course, this group is very influential. This group which worships at the shrine of Marx, but honors him with their mouth while their heart is far from him. Then there are the revisionists implicit. And you go behind the iron and bamboo curtains. They got to be implicit revisionists because they're sort of like the Missouri Synod. Though their heart, too, may be far from him, they cannot admit that they have departed from the true word and doctrine. I'm Missouri Synod, in case you they have, every one of the countries that we today call communist, with the possible exception of East Germany and Czechoslovakia, has no business being a socialist country. Because it just hasn't gone through any of the stages that Marx said you had to go through in order to be socialist. These non-industrialized countries just shouldn't have been socialist. They hadn't gone through their capitalist stage yet. You have to be bourgeois before you can be post-bourgeois. But here they are, socialist, revering Marx, big pictures and busts and statues of him all over the place. In what sense are they Marxist? Again, they don't admit it, but they're Marxist in a proof passage sense. They go through Marx and borrow proof passages where it suits their fancy. And of course, where Marx said, the big Marx, the broad picture of Marx that Marx tries to present, that they ignore. They have to ignore it because it's just totally irrelevant to their situation. Well, the politically important forms of socialism today, then, are un-Marxist. And they are the two main types. There now, here's my point. There is available in our world a good, rational critique, a provocative, stimulating, rational critique of capitalism. It's not up to date in all respects, but it's good. It's really worth getting into. Well, it takes a lot of effort. And that is Karl Marx's. But if Karl Marx was a socialist, or Karl Marx defines socialism, then there aren't any influential socialists in the world today. At least there aren't any influential Marxists. That is to say, there aren't any influential socialists who base their socialism upon a rational critique of capitalism. There are rather the revisionists explicit and the revisionists implicit. And I'd like to just draw some rough contrasts so that you notice something. If you, over here I put the Fabians. Now let's notice some characteristics of societies or nations today which could be roughly called Fabian socialists. They tend to be, one, industrialized and wealthy, don't they? Whereas the implicit revisionists, the so-called communist countries, they tend to be non-industrialized and poor. And if you say to me, well, but Russia, she's not industrialized and getting wealthy. And I will show you tomorrow that Russia is moving over here very rapidly. That's what I'm going to do tomorrow. Show the evolution of Russia, especially in the last 2 years. Oh, yeah, thank you. It just proves I live in an affluent society. Okay. Another thing, these countries, I'm thinking of England, France, occasionally. France can't make a run.
the Scandinavian countries, certainly, and the Low countries, and you may want to, those of you who are Republicans may want to say, in the United States, too, under the Democrats, I don't know. But parliamentary democracy, very characteristic of these countries. Whereas over here, you've got non-liberal political traditions. Another contrast. Their socialism, if you want to call that, is evolutionary. I mean, you never knew when it came. You just woke up and said, by golly, I think we've got it. Norman Thomas, he's a good classic example. You may disagree, you may say we aren't as socialist as he says, or we're more socialist, but Norman Thomas says, I quit running for the presidency because we got what I wanted. At what point did Britain become socialist? The Labour government took over after the war, and they nationalized a few industries, and they brought in national health insurance, but that really wasn't a big departure. It was a continuation of things that had begun before the war under the Tories. Then the Tories came back in, they didn't change any of it. Or look at the Scandinavian countries. However, over here you usually have a sharp break, let's call it revolutionary. I mean, it could be a real coup d'etat or a general civil war or just an expropriation of the capitalists or something like that, or driving out of the foreigners. Usually a sharp break, and by golly, you know it. Yesterday you were safe, and today you may get your head cut off. Here you have the characteristic feature of these countries is, I think, the welfare state. That's about all you can say, that's the thing they have in common. They're very interested in providing welfare, security, from cradle to grave, or from womb to tomb, or, as you say, from sperm to worm. Whereas over here, you've got much more state control, state ownership and control of the means of production. That's minimized in most of these countries. Here you have, by and large, a very pragmatic approach to government and the administration of economic life. No, if it works, try it. If it doesn't work, look at the Labour Party. Labour Party today in England is saying things like, has socialism failed? And they're discussing that. Do we have anything to contribute? You can't do that if you're ideological. But in these countries, everything is very ideological. The faith is never doubted for a moment. It's marching forward. The party has the truth. And forward we go. You tend to have charismatic leaders. Here, in these countries, the principal stretch, the goal, I would say, the goal, the big goal is equality. Now, we might call it equity, justice, but equality is what we're after. Something, fair shares for all. Whereas in these countries, what do you suppose the big goal is? Growth. Now, of course, they bow in the direction of equality, but they're not remotely interested. Growth is what they're after. In these countries, you have lots of market. Markets do control the bulk of economic activity in the so-called socialist countries of Western Europe. And of course, in the socialist United States, if you want to call it socialist. Remember, I keep saying it because I don't know what socialism means. But here you have poorly developed market institutions. All right, now I think these are meaningful contrasts between these two kinds of country. And the thing that strikes me about it is that it isn't so much a matter of, let me put it this way. We tend to feel that these countries are our real enemies, don't we? These are the socialist countries. We like them. They're okay. We may criticize them. We may say they're stupid. But we get along with them. They join NATO and SATO, and they're our friends. We go to their countries and visit them and drink their wine. These countries, though, we don't like. They're dangerous. They make trouble in the world. They are our enemies. They tend to line up with our enemies. These are the bad guys and these are the fairly good guys. Well, is it because these are communist and these are socialist? Or is it for some other reason? Why should this be? Why should these countries be our enemies? That's an intriguing question. It is not, is it, because they said, hey, there are two camps in the world. There's the U.S. democratic, free, capitalist camp, and there's the communist, totalitarian dictatorship camp. Let's join the communist, totalitarian dictatorship camp. We sometimes pretend that the people of India are sitting around looking and see, hey, the U.S. lost prestige yesterday, and so let's become communists. This is so ridiculous. Really, isn't it true that fundamentally history, to the weasel word, has divided countries into these two groups? These countries are the product of a different history than these countries. I mean, I prefer all these things myself. I prefer to be rich and industrialized and democratic and evolutionary, and I like to stress the welfare state over state control because it's a lot more freedom. I like to be pragmatic and just and have market institutions. But that ain't a possibility over here. That is not a live possibility for most of these countries. And we nag them because they aren't like this. But they can't be like this. Now, maybe when countries are in this position, they are our enemies. Maybe.
And very good reason why that might be so. They have very little. And they have a hunch that one of the reasons why they have so little is that we stole a lot of it from them in the 19th century. Right or wrong, they believe that. And they say the only way we're going to get our place in the sun is by separating ourselves from these foreign demons, the capitalist, colonialist, imperialist powers, except insofar as we can milk something out of them. It's rational. Well, tomorrow I want to take a look at just focus on the Soviet economy and how it has evolved. And what I'm going to be trying to show you is that the Soviet Union is moving rapidly out of this camp into this camp, more rapidly in some respects than in other respects. So it isn't really possible that they're coming all the way over. In some of these areas, they're still very much over here. But does that mean that the Soviet Union will soon be our friend? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know that. Time to quit. You get a couple of minutes to stretch.